This is The Reason Interview, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Before we get to today's program, which I want to tell you is really pretty great, I want to let you know about some exciting changes. We used to publish all of our podcasts on a single feed titled The Reason Podcast, but today we're dividing up our offerings into three great new shows. They include this show, The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, which comes out every Wednesday and features what I hope are relentlessly interesting interviews with the activists, the artists, authors, entrepreneurs, newsmakers, and politicians who are defining the 21st century. Then there's The Reason Roundtable, a weekly discussion of news and analysis released every Monday and moderated by Matt Welch. It features me, Catherine Menga Ward, and Peter Suderman as regular guests. And then there's the Soho Forum Debates, a libertarian-themed debate series recorded monthly before a live audience in New York City. Moderated by former Barron's economics editor Gene Epstein, the Soho Forum Debates features Nobel Prize winners, radical thinkers, and other public intellectuals facing off over the future of Bitcoin, veganism, sex work, illegal drugs, electric vehicles, abortion, robotics, government debt, and other controversial topics. These shows used to all go out under the single title of The Reason Podcast, but now they're going out under their own titles. We're releasing today's episode of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, this very program, on the original Reason Podcast feed, and that's probably how you're listening to it right now. But this is the last time we'll do that. So to make sure that you don't miss my interviews, which drop every Wednesday, you have to subscribe to The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. You can find it at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, or by going to reason.com/podcasts. So please subscribe today and don't miss a single episode. And now, on to The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Megan Daum, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hi, great to be here, Nick.
So let's start. Your book is at least a couple of things. And, you know, first and foremost, I think it's an engagement and critique of what you call fourth wave feminism. But it's also a memoir of a Gen X childhood and a brand of both femaleness and kind of toughness that seems to be in retrograde. So I want to talk about both of those things as well as a bunch of other things. But let's start with the fourth wave feminism dimension. What is it and what's your beef with it?
I would describe fourth wave feminism as something very much so, if not really almost entirely social media based. It has to do with expressions of empowerment, solidarity, however you want to think of it, in terms of memes and hashtags. I started noticing it maybe around 2014, early 2015. A lot of it coincided with a lot of the issues that were coming up around sexual assault policies on college campuses. But a lot of it was and continues to be really sort of rooted in this idea that we're going to complain a lot about men and sort of punch up
who's
at
we,
men.
Kemosabe?
We meaning, yeah, good question. So, I mean, these are young women, women in their 20s, women in high school. But the funny thing is a lot of older women and middle-aged women are sort of glomming onto this the way one does if you want to stay with the times, I suppose. And, I just want to say at the outset here, I consider myself a feminist. I have always been a feminist. I'm a liberal. I think I'm a liberal. Increasingly, I'm informed that I am not. But, that's a whole other road to go down. But, you know, I really what troubled me and what it interested me was, you know, I had grown up sort of right alongside second wave feminism. So I was born in 1970.
Yeah, and let's just to define our terms a little bit here. First wave feminism is kind of it culminates in the right to vote.
Yeah, the
and
suffragists.
It's 19th century
that was, right,
and
late
early
19th
20th
century, early 20th.
Second wave feminism is kind of post-war stuff. So that's Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique. Gloria Steinem, late 60s, early 70s,
Ms. Magazine, kind of consciousness raising.
Third wave feminism then, it gets a little bit softer.
Yeah, third wave feminism, you know, it's funny, that third wave was actually defined, you know, coined by Rebecca Walker.
Alice Walker's daughter.
That's right. They had a huge falling out over definitions of feminism. I don't know if there's anything more, you can't get more feminist than, you know, becoming estranged from your feminist
mother.
This
is as somebody who, you know, toils within the subculture of libertarianism and knows a lot of communists. I appreciate how subcultures, you know, become more and more kind of angry with internecine conflict.
What would be the point of being in a subculture?
But third wave feminism, then, that is kind of like Bitch Magazine. It's Alanis Morissette. It's girl power.
It's hard to say. I feel like third wave feminism, I think it was Rebecca Walker herself said, you know, the defining feature of third wave feminism is that it's impossible to define. So, you know, what is now being called fourth wave, and that's not a term that gets bandied around too much. I'm just sort of using it for my own definitional purposes here. But it is this kind of hashtag kill all men. The columnist Jessica Valenti, who I quote a couple times throughout the book, she was the founder of Feministing, which was a feminist website, and she's very, very popular. She's actually a Gen Xer, but she's very popular among these sort of younger millennial Gen Z feminists.
You talk about in the book an episode that might kind of exemplify kind of fourth wave feminism, or at least the tensions within feminism, when the writer of the Bustle.com story about Aziz Ansari and his date with Babe.net. But really, when the author of that story, the story was told to her by an anonymous source about this day with Aziz Ansari. But it really, the attack that the author made on Ashley Banfield, a newscaster who's, you know, I guess a Gen Xer actually, and a Canadian as well.
Oh.
So that's a whole other problem. But
there's intersectionality for you.
But kind of that, right, where, you know, she was, when Banfield said, you know, she was talking about the story on the air, and she said, you know, this is a story about a bad date, kind of get over it. And then the writer said, like, oh, fuck yourself, you know, with your bad dye job,
your,
et cetera.
Your burgundy lipstick.
Yeah.
Right. So just to back up on that, the case with Aziz Ansari, I mean, I don't know how much listeners already know about this, but just to go over it really briefly, so that, you know, in the wake of Me Too, you know, that was all happening sort of fall of 2017. This is early 2018, I believe. The comedian Aziz Ansari, who had this sort of woke reputation, right? You know, he would show up on the red carpet.
He had written a book about, like, dating etiquette in the modern age.
Yes, and he would show up on the red carpet with Time's Up pins and this kind of thing. And all of a sudden, this anonymous piece appeared on this website that nobody had ever heard of, called Babe.net, which described a date that this woman had gone on with Aziz Ansari, where she felt that she was just uncomfortable with the date. And it was, you know, not entirely clear what had gone on, but, you know, it definitely did not sound like a fun time, but also not like anything that she couldn't get out of. It didn't ring to my ears anyway as a particularly dangerous situation. Anyway, this as told to piece went viral, and it really, that was the moment, I think, where the generational lines just split down the middle. The reaction from younger feminists was, oh my gosh, he is a terrible person. This is unacceptable. This is toxic masculinity. If you're in a sexual situation and he makes you feel uncomfortable, then that is exactly the problem. This is sort of on the rape spectrum in some way.
Right.
And then the older women were kind of like, whoa, like the record scratched. Like, wait a second here. What? Like, we're having really serious discussions around people like Harvey Weinstein and Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer. And suddenly, like, this, you're putting in the same category. And that was really a flashpoint in all of this, because it was like suddenly the two generations were just not understanding each other.
And you wrote, you know, that at the beginning of the book, you said you had started this book right before the 2016 election, and you expected Hillary Clinton to win, and you were going to write a book, you say, about feminism and only feminism.
Yes.
And then it became something else, because Donald Trump is kind, you know, I mean, he has thrown everybody for a loop, including himself, you know, by all accounts.
Like, no one was more surprised and disappointed than Donald Trump himself at the outcome of the election.
Yeah, I mean, he really was about to call for a recount. But, you know, what was the book you would have written had Hillary won? And then, you know, where is the space we are now? And then we're going to broaden it out to, you know, because it's not just the problem with feminism or the problem with certain aspects of society. Your book is the problem with everything.
Yes.
And we are living in this kind of bizarre shitstorm post 2016.
Yeah. So, like I said, I started thinking about this stuff probably 2014. 2016, I was really going to write a pretty contained, discreet book. And the concept was, you are not a badass. So there were these sort of expressions in third wave feminism where it was like, you wake up every morning and face down the patriarchy and it's all you're so under the thumb of this oppression that, you know, just paying your rent on time and showing up to work makes you a badass. Like, it's so difficult to be a woman. Like, this was somehow the messaging. And, you know, you could buy a t-shirt that said feminist in rhinestone lettering. And I just thought it was really strange because as a Gen Xer, I had grown up in the 70s and 80s, never having any concept that I was anything but equal to boys. In fact, most girls were better than boys. They were doing better in school. The world was...
There was not a sitcom that didn't have an episode where the girls beat the boys and the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family.
Right.
Facts of Life, you know, obviously the Facts of Life girls were, you know, doing well.
Yes, those were four badasses if there ever were. But yeah, I mean, and you know, we can talk about this later, but I do think there was something about growing up in the 70s as a child. It was a much more androgynous period. You didn't have the like extreme girliness, the blue toy aisle and the pink toy aisle.
So this was a and I realized we're kind of blending these things together, which I guess is kind of what happened with you. You were going
right.
to write about feminism, but then it really becomes, you know, this is a Gen X memoir.
Yes.
And it is, talk a bit then about the two things that seem to stand out or that you are calling attention to as somebody raised during the 70s and 80s, and you mentioned them, androgyny and toughness. And because so the androgyny, it's that, you know, this was an era on the one hand of David Bowie and Twiggy, like kind of being the same, or Patti Smith
and,
she was a tough, not really a tough broad because she was both female but asexual.
Yeah, and
well,
even people like Chrissy Hynde. I mean, there was just an aesthetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I found it curious that suddenly the sort of premise of feminism was that women were somehow weaker or being weakened by men. And so, you know, assuming that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president, I just said, okay, let me just take a hammer to all of this. I'm going to do some sort of manifesto like, women, get your acts together. We have a woman in the White House. Let's move on. So that didn't happen. And so, yes, to answer your question.
And it's not just that Hillary Clinton lost. It's that she lost to the return of the repressed.
Right.
I mean, Donald Trump is he's not even like a 50s man. He's not, you know, he's not a Beaver Cleaver.
No, he's a cartoon villain.
He is Harvey Weinstein. I mean, you know, he's a pussy grabber by his own account. You know, he's a,
right.
What the hell is a simulacrum of like a piggish man, a copy, an imitation of something that never quite existed.
Right, right. He's like the Frankenstein of all toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Yes. So realizing at that point that I had to open up the book. So it was really about much more than feminism and about this kind of wokeness culture in general. By that time, woke had become a household word, more or less. And you know, ultimately, I thought that there was something much subtler and more important going on than just talking about feminism. And I kind of wanted to talk about this ethos of social justice and you know, the sort of intersection between social justice and the sort of like post-structuralist theory and where everything was going wrong and you know, how the extreme right and the extreme left were almost meeting, like the horseshoe theory sort of thing. But it was really abstract and it was very hard to get a handle on. So I realized that I needed to frame the book around my own sort of coming of age as a person, as a woman, as a feminist, and also just really getting older as a Gen Xer.
I have to say, as somebody who I've got up more than a few years on you, welcome to the club. You know, this is intersectionality we don't really talk about. Among the many identities that could take into account is just getting older.
Yes. Yeah. Is that, that's an identity group?
Oh, well, certainly. Yeah. And this is, unfortunately, I think is going to become worse. And, you know, when you look at like the three, you know, the 2020 presidential race is going to be between people who are in their 70s.
Right.
You know, it's like the elderly are going to become increasingly the aged, a horrifying, identity that
I know.
Be grappling
so,
with.
Right. But,
so you're talking though about, I mean, so you started out, you wanted to write about kind of feminism in, you know, in a world where we have a female president.
Yes.
That goes away. And then Trump is elected. But you are talking, you know, the subtitle is My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. And I guess wokeness is really the one of the cruxes here. And would you define wokeness? I mean, obviously, it's partly, you know, it's about being sensitive to everybody's identities and everybody's issues. But you seem to be framing it in many ways as like Gen X and maybe even boomers in this sense were tough. And millennials and Gen Z are really sensitive.
Yeah. So one of my sort of working theories in the book, and this doesn't sort of lay exactly on top of wokeness, but you know, it occurred to me that Gen Xers really grew up fetishizing toughness in a way. Like it was important to sort of not show that you were upset. It was, you know, I'm talking in very broad strokes, but you know, our parents went to work. We were the latchkey kids, and you know, there was a real pride in sort of making it on your own, taking care of yourself. You know, there was something almost exciting if you broke your arm and you went to school in a cast, that sort of thing. And it's, you know, as we grew older, the sort of 90s Gen X, reputation was all about aloofness and irony, detachment, you know.
But you make a pretty strong case, really, that it's about toughness.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
Really
I think
the,
it is about toughness.
You know, that's the core
yes.
of the Gen X
And I
identity.
Think the aloofness and all of that folds into it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then I really wonder if millennials and Gen Z have a similar way of fetishizing fairness. Like they have grown up with, you know, all sorts of messages about inclusivity and, you know, if equality of opportunity should necessarily equal equality of outcome, all these sorts of ideas. And those are good ideas, the same way that being tough is a good thing. But it seems like, you know, we maybe have too much of each. We need to sort of have an exchange across
Talk
the aisle.
Talk a bit more about, you've taught at a number of universities. You currently teach at Columbia. At various points, you talk about conversations that you have with your students and whatnot. And I think, you know, one example that comes through is pretty good is that you have the students discuss Rent, the play, and I guess it was eventually made into a movie. And then you show them the Team America parody of the big
yes.
production number in Rent done by the South Park guys.
Yes.
Would you discuss a little bit about what's going on there and how you think that illuminates a kind of, you know, meaningful difference between younger people and older people?
Yeah, well, I think part of what was going on there was that I was a visiting professor in this program. This was at the University of Iowa, so I could not get fired. And there was really no point in anyone reporting me to the dean. So yeah, I was teaching a cultural criticism seminar. And it became really sort of frustrating because I couldn't get through a lot of the material. We would read sort of cultural pieces that seemed anodyne to me, and they would just think, you know, we would read a Mary Gateskill piece from Harper's from the 90s, and they would think, well, there's too much internalized misogyny here. I can't get anything through. You know, we'd read Christopher Hitchens, and they would like have to go to the hospital practically. So, yes, but I had taught.
And I realize I may be misremembering, but in a previous conversation, we talked about James Baldwin as being a problematic writer.
Well, I don't think that it's funny, he's sainted at this point, but he certainly, if he were around today, I think he would be problematic, and I think he would have plenty to say
right.
about all this. We read Baldwin, and that went okay. But I taught them an essay by the late David Rakoff, who was a just brilliant writer, and he has this wonderful essay about the musical Rent, and you know, it was such a huge hit in the mid 90s, and it was just, you know, it was the woke
the woke version of La Boheme, right?
Yes. Well, and also it was, it was about AIDS. It was about,
increasingly now that AIDS doesn't really exist in the same way, it's really about rent control, which is bad.
Right.
Fairness. Again.
So, and it was really one of these things where every, basically by the end of the show, every character is infected with HIV, even like people who never had sex or people's dogs or whatever. So, and it was really emblematic of its time because there was so much, the public health message around HIV was like, you know, alarmism. We had to have that in order to get anything done. Okay. So, I had them look at the piece, this essay, and then I had them watch a clip from Rent itself, which really does not hold up very well. And they were sort of horrified by the schmaltziness of it. And then, so the film Team America World Police, which is one of these, sort of scatological marionette movies
let's be clear, it is probably the only scatological puppet movie, marionette movie, right?
This is not a whole genre.
I hope you gotta get out more.
I don't know. I think there's entire closets of your Blockbuster video store.
That's true.
That
yes.
Had.
Yeah.
So there's I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but there's a scene where they have to recruit somebody to join this police force of saving the world. And one of the people they have to recruit is this actor who is performing in a production of, it's called Lease. So there's this whole big number, just showstopper, everyone on stage. And the musical number is called Everybody Has AIDS. And it's just this like totally irreverent send up of the message around the AIDS crisis. And it was like AIDS. And, their 47-year-old professor, I played this for them. I've watched this clip numerous times. I really think it's one of the funniest things, in existence. And I was practically falling out of my chair, practically like peeing in my pants. And they just kind of looked at me in utter horror. And, I really had to ask myself, I think, in fairness, a few of them are laughing, but, I really, at the sort of that moment, I said, what am I doing this for? Like, why do I even care? Why do I need to shove this down their throats? Why am I so obsessed with this generational divide and humor and irony? And like, what does it matter if they think this is funny or not?
So here's a question for you. If in a way, and this is simplifying things, and I think you're right that, maybe Gen X or older people, fetishize toughness and younger people fetishize wokeness. We need to meet somewhere in the middle because each of these things has its virtues. Can you talk a bit about how we got from one place to the other? And I'm thinking in one part of the book, you talk, I think this is exactly on point, where during the 70s and 80s, women started going back into the workforce, not simply rejoining the workforce, but, administrative and management and supervisory roles in more or less equal positions to men, not fully, but we're getting there. Suddenly there became a moment where, as a nation, we had ongoing moral and social panics over abducted children. So,
yes.
In a weird way, right at a moment when women are being liberated from the house and from being in the kitchen and going into the office suite and things like
middle that. Middle class and upper middle class women, by the way, because poor women had always worked.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, but then we suddenly everything that we're, every time we're eating breakfast cereals, we're seeing milk boxes with missing kids. What was going on there? And then what is the effect that you think that that kind of mentality or that kind of mostly implicit backlash, it seems. What were the effects that it had on younger people?
I was just sort of missed that. I mean, I remember when Eitan Peitz was abducted, and I talk about that a little bit in the book. I just don't think it's any accident that this happened right when you had all these mothers going to work. You're swept up in the 80s and, all the women were putting their Nike running shoes on with their power
working
suits.
Girl,
yes.
All of that type of stuff.
And, there was a great excitement around this, but then, this sort of cross current came in and saying, well, oh, not so fast. You can't leave your kids. They're not safe. You need to go back into the home.
And you got to be playing Mozart to them in the womb.
Right. Well,
and
then that started.
Enriching their fucking, you know, cribs, you know, with scientifically designed mobiles that will make them super geniuses.
And, you know, when we have 24-hour news, you know, you start to see, you know, it's not like crime has increased. It's actually gone down. But because we're seeing every single thing that happens, and that now with social media, that's exponentially worse. I mean, you would think there's a police shooting, you know, every 5 seconds in every block of every city. So, but yeah, I think, you know, there was a there became an obsession with safety. But, you know, another thing, and I sort of entertained this in a half-baked way. And the more I think about it, I think there might be really something here. When you started to be able to tell the sex of the baby in utero, I wonder if that set up a gender binary that became more pronounced than it was before. Like, if suddenly babies are being brought home to nurseries that have been decorated for boys or decorated for girls, the parents are unconsciously, you know, set up a whole kind of narrative around the child. I wonder if that really created a sort of extreme gender roles that we just didn't have to deal with in the 70s. And that has perhaps caused the kind of backlash that we're seeing now around gender.
You know, maybe some of that backlash to kind of, you know, move towards actual lived female equality explains some of the change in attitudes towards kids that lead towards, you know, we don't have to go full John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, but, you know, full coddling of kids who are less resilient, who take every, you know, real and perceived slight as like a massive wound against their identity in a way that, you know, we were, you know, taught in the 70s and 80s, you know, like rub some dirt on it or spit on it and walk it off, right?
Yes, I mean, put some butter on it. Remember, was that an SNL sketch?
Yeah. You know, so there's that. But then, you know, where do you see this all heading? You know, and in the book, you talk about, you know, about maybe 2019 or maybe the current moment, like, you know, cancel culture has kind of burnt itself out. How would we know when that happens? And what is a good resolution to, again, if we're talking about this in terms of, and I hadn't really thought about this until we started talking, you know, a kind of dialectic between toughness and wokeness, you know, what's a good resolution to that? And how do we know when we've gotten to a better place than we are right now?
Well, the short answer is, if everybody gets canceled, we can just hit a reset and we can start over again. So in a way, I want cancel culture to go on a little bit longer so we can all just be canceled. You know, beyond that, I think people are really craving complexity. I mean, we're in this moment where we think in memes, we talk in tweets. If you try to make a complicated point, not only is that discouraged, you can get penalized. Like, you know, if you try to say something like, well, you know, for instance, the gender wage gap. Yes, there is a gender wage gap. Let's look at why it might be. Is it because women make certain choices? Why do they make those choices? If we want to solve this, we need to, you know, recognize that there are certain realities. By the time I even got halfway through that sentence, there would be people who would slap me down as a victim blamer, as an internalized misogynist, part of the problem. And so, you know, we're not able to have conversations.
You did dedicate the book to your father.
I did.
Yeah, why not your mother?
I dedicated another book to my mother.
All right. So she got there first.
She did.
Okay.
She did.
That's good to know.
Yes. So she's had been covered plenty in my previous work.
You know, when you talk about kind of, again, I'm thinking now in terms of dialectic here or extremes, you know, on the one hand, we have things like, you know, Twitter and meme culture, which is incredibly brief. Although Twitter doubled, you know, we can be twice as complex on Twitter.
Yes, we can be 280 words of complex.
But, you know, there on the one hand, there is that move towards absolute radical simplicity, where if it doesn't fit on like a single panel meme, forget it. And on another level, and this includes, you know, writing at a place like Medium and whatnot, there and on YouTube, increasingly, we see this move towards really long form journalism. And, you know, when you think of YouTube shows or podcasts that go on for hours.
Yes.
You know, Joe Rogan can have a million people watching or listening to a 3-hour long podcast. It's kind of it's a very bizarre world we live in. That is, you know, where the contrasts seem to be extremely stark and growing in many ways.
But I think it's very telling that podcasts are so popular. I mean, that increasingly is the space where you can listen in on private conversations. I mean, really, the most interesting conversations are being held in private because it's so risky to have them in a public space. So the closest we have to the private and public are these podcast discussions. And I certainly got very hooked on them. I mean, a huge part of the book talks about, you know, I got divorced and my husband had really been the person that I talked to about everything. The problem with everything refers to the ongoing conversation that we had. He was my intellectual ally. And when I lost that, I turned to all these podcasts and these YouTube conversations. And that's really what sort of set me on this path to thinking about this stuff.
Would you discuss that a little bit? Because I think in a certain level, you obviously had a large readership to begin with, but then you wrote a piece, is it a year and a half ago or so?
It was last August. It was August 2018,
About your kind of flirtation with what has become known as the intellectual dark web. And, you know, that was a tremendous piece. To read, it was extremely exciting because, you know, in the best essays are the ones where, you know, as the reader, you don't know exactly how it's going to end up, and the writer doesn't really know. It's almost like a performative work of art because, you know, the writer is discovering as they're going along. Discuss the themes in that and how that kind of reflects back on the theme of the problem with everything.
Yeah. So the piece was called Nuance, A Love Story. And it was, you know, the book was underway at that time, and I had been writing a little bit about the intellectual dark web, and I hadn't planned on publishing, you know, this as a piece, but then suddenly everybody was talking about the intellectual dark web. And I said, hey, wait a second, I knew this band before anybody knew them. So,
which is a very Gen X thing
yes,
to do, right?
Yes.
To claim that you were bored with them by the time,
IDW signed
with a major label.
I hated them before they had a second single. So it's a very long piece, and it's about really how I had this intellectual allyship with my husband. He's also a journalist, and you know, we were very amicably divorced. But I really, in my new sort of singleness and in my new kind of aloneness, I became really drawn into people having nuanced conversations on podcasts and online, and that was because at this time there was an increasing gulf between what I actually thought and what I thought I was supposed to think, because this is starting to be around when the wokeness was emerging, when Trump won the election, and a lot of my friends, people that I had considered very close to me, very much aligned with me politically, we started to have some differences that I found surprising and troubling. So it was a lot of my sort of, you know, posse and the, you know, left, center left, whatever, you know, elite media, smart people world, I started to feel very distanced from them. And it was a really lonely feeling. And loneliness is a lot of what animates this book as well. Aging and loneliness.
Well, so, you know, and it's funny because I have down here, you know, some of the problems that you're dealing with. One is that you say, like, we're all really lonely in a way that we may not have been before. And there's sociological data to suggest that we interact less with other people than we might have, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But then you also say, and again, this is that contrast, which is pretty interesting, that we also know too much of what's going on.
Yes.
Because there's a not even confessional dimension, but an exhibitionist dimension to social media and to the way we live now.
Right. So we can get completely caught up in ideas about school shootings or climate change. I don't want to say hysteria because that sounds diminishing, but you know, there is a sense that we are in like a 24-hour emergency, and it's like a red alert. Like, yeah, we're in a crisis. It's a pretty bad time, but it's not like you can't get out of bed every morning. And I think that there is, you know, it feeds off of itself. If you go on Facebook and people are just saying, oh my gosh, I'm having to take, you know, antidepressants. I have anxiety. I'm afraid to send my daughter to college because 1 in 4 women are raped. You know, the world is going to end in 10 years because of climate change. I'm not going to, you know, use any more straws or flat. It's like there's a reward system for carrying on like that. And so I see why people do it. They're lonely, so they say it, and then other people will echo it. But, you know, then that just creates a kind of like just default setting of alarmism that doesn't really line up with reality.
What did, you know, thinking about it in those terms, and you've written a novel, you're a writer by trade. You know, what is the role of, I don't know if it's fiction or if it's essays or if it's other more contemplative forms, like, you know, novels, memoir, essays. There doesn't seem to be in some way as much space for interior thought. I mean, everything is immediate. Everything is public. You know, is that part of the problem here? And do we need to recover? And I hesitate to say that as somebody who spent years studying literature, I don't want to just be like, oh, well, what I happened to study when I was younger, you know, is the antidote to things.
Right.
But what are the ways that we regain a sense of perspective and balance between, you know, urgent or maybe not so urgent political or external threats and, you know, having a sense of identity and, you know, that is rooted in something other than panic?
I think we have to just allow ourselves to be conflicted. I mean, really, that's at the root of this. You know, I say this to my students, if you're not conflicted, you're either lying or you're not very smart, right? I mean, you can't, all of my writing, you know, when I was a columnist for years, this was my approach and very much still here. I'm not trying to convince you to come over to my side. I'm not really making an argument. I'm inviting the reader to think alongside me as I try to sort things through. So, you know, this book, it's really, I'm self-scrutinizing. It's a self-examination. It's not a polemic.
Right.
And so I think, you know, to answer your question, what's missing is just a willingness to sort of sit in your own confusion, because it's uncomfortable and it's not rewarded, frankly. And I think, again, the role of the writer, whether you're a novelist or journalist, essayist, whatever, is to say the things that might confuse readers and say the things that might upset them and might make them mad at you and send you hate mail. That's actually the job. What I find astonishing are the amount of people in media, journalists, writers, who really have just decided that they're going to say the obvious, that they're going to make a career out of identifying their audience and giving the audience what that audience expects again and again and again. And, you know, people will say things to me in private like, oh, well, you know, what I really think is this, you know, it's not quite as simple as what I say when I write or in social media or whatever, but I would never want to say that. It's like, why are you in the job? What are we doing here? To me, what's satisfying about being a writer is being able to say the thing that a lot of people are thinking, but afraid to say or can't articulate it or whatever. Otherwise, what's the point? I would much rather like be in a band or something, you know. Like,
I would, but I don't have any musical talent. Maybe not
well,
any writing
that
talent.
That hasn't stopped anybody from being in a Gen X band anyway.
Yeah, that might have been a precondition, right? And you accidentally discover talent. Let's leave it there. I have been talking with Megan Daum. She's the author most recently of a fantastic new book called The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Megan, thanks for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I am Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. And please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Google, at Apple, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.